It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out about a statewide civics competition for Wisconsin high schoolers. First, during this year's State of the Union address, President Trump said that his administration is committed to tackling the high cost of medical care in the United States.
The next major priority for me and for all of us should be to lower the cost of health care and prescription drugs and to protect patients with pre-existing conditions.
Throughout the address, he doubled down on his call for lower and clearer drug pricing and repeated his complaint that Americans pay the highest amount for drugs in the world. Our next guest is here to break down President Trump's stance on drug prices, why drug prices are as expensive as they are, and what sort of reforms could be put into place to alleviate the cost for patients. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
First, why has President Trump singled out this issue in particular for attention and action?
Well, because this is an issue that kind of spans the parties of people who are upset. They don't like high health care prices in particular. They don't like high drug prices specifically. And it's something that he has really sort of championed since he was a candidate. In fact, the administration last year put out an entire blueprint of possible ways to reduce drug prices, although so far nobody's had very good luck at doing this.
Well, let's take a quick listen to what he specifically said in the State of the Union about those drug prices.
It's unacceptable that Americans pay vastly more than people in other countries for the exact same drugs, often made in the exact same place. This is wrong. This is unfair. And together, we will stop it. And we'll stop it fast.
So, Julie, President Trump frequently points to what he thinks are unfair drug prices and compares them to other countries quite a bit. First, on average, can you tell us how much more expensive are prescription medications in the United States?
Well, prescription medications are much more expensive in the United States. It varies, of course, by the country. But the bottom line is almost every other country has some kind of government way to regulate drug prices. And in the United States, we pretty much don't. There are some regulated drug prices. There are some prices that are regulated under Medicare. There's Medicaid. They're required to give discounts. But basically, we rely on the private market to try to negotiate drug prices, and no one really has enough bargaining power to do anything about them, as opposed to other countries where the governments actually do the regulating themselves.
It seems like I've actually heard that there are things put in place that prevent, even if states or regions wanted to get together and try to do that bulk buying that you were talking about, that other countries are able to, that there are actually things put in place to prevent that.
There are, part of it is the way the market is set up. There are multiple different buyers. We have the Medicare program, the Medicaid program, which is different in every state. We have the Veterans Administration, which has its own system for buying drugs, and then private insurance, which has yet its own system for buying drugs. So there are so many different ways that drugs are purchased. And then, of course, there's people who just go out and buy their own drugs, that there really is no single system, and people then end up impinging on other systems when they try to change things. Under Medicare, though, when Congress added prescription drugs to Medicare in 2003, there was a specific ban on Medicare negotiating drug prices, at least for those outpatient drugs. Now, Medicare pays for inpatient drugs, drugs that are delivered in hospitals and in doctors' office, most cancer chemotherapy, for example, and Medicare has a complicated way of paying for those drugs that most people think is inflationary, basically gives an incentive for drug companies to charge more and for the doctors to have the drug companies charge more because the doctors get to keep a portion. So there's all these different ways that we pay for drugs, and pretty much all of them are pushing prices higher.
So we're talking about prescription drugs, but that's a huge heading of medications. There are generics, there are name brand drugs, there are very commonly used drugs, there are drugs that are used in only a very small number of cases, but very serious cases, and the need is certainly there for those patients. What goes into the cost of getting a prescription drug to the market?
Well, the prescription drug makers will tell you that it costs more than $1 billion to bring a new drug from discovery to market. There are a lot of regulatory requirements by the Food and Drug Administration. They have to do a lot of clinical trials. It is labor and time intensive and very expensive. But in the United States, for the most part, the drug companies can charge pretty much whatever they want. In some cases, they say they charge more in the United States because they can't charge enough in many of those other countries to make back their investment. So in some sense, this president is correct when he says that consumers in the United States are helping subsidize the cost of drugs in other countries. There are things that should help push down the price of drugs. Generic competition. When there is a generic competitor, the price of the brand name drug tends to come down. But what we've seen over many years is a brand name drug companies finding ways to deter those generics from coming to market. In some cases, they literally pay the generic drug maker who gets the first drug approved to not market that drug for a period of time. The generic drug maker makes money. The brand name drug maker doesn't have the competition. In some cases, they prevent makers of generic drugs from getting samples of the medication so that they can copy them. So that makes it difficult for there to be more generics. There's just so many players in the drug market beyond the drug makers and the people who are buying them that it is very difficult to get a handle on all of it.
We're talking with Julie Rovner right now. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she hosts the KHN's podcast, What the Health. And we're talking about the high cost of prescription drugs and calls from President Trump to address that issue. And Julie, this is not a new issue for President Trump. He called for cheaper medications even in last year's State of the Union address. Here's what he had to say in 2018.
Already as a result of my administration's efforts in 2018, drug prices experienced their single largest decline in 46 years.
So, Julie, saying that it's the biggest decrease in prices in 46 years, is that accurate, first of all?
Not really. There were some declines. In some cases, the administration sort of talked down drug makers, asked them to please not raise drug prices in 2018. And in some cases, drug makers didn't do that. And then when it became January of 2019, they all raised their prices. So there was a little bit of that. But we're still seeing individual drugs go up sometimes by significant amounts, as you point out. It depends on the drug. It depends on how many people take it. Depends whether or not there's generic competition or even other brand name competition, whether it's whether it's a drug that is a blockbuster drug that no other drug can do that job, or whether there are multiple brand name drugs that can that treat the same condition.
President Trump said in last year's address that there had been an influx of generic medications on the market. Typically, it would seem that generics would be a good thing for consumers, that there's a less expensive non-brand name drug available. But is the introduction of more generics always a plus for the public?
Usually, but as I mentioned, there is a generic, but then it ends up not being sold. There have been some stories recently about quality issues with some generics. In general, generics, they're not approved unless they are what's called bioequivalent, that they have to act the same way as the brand name drug. But there have been some cases where it's not clear that that all of the requirements have been met. It is much more difficult to make generic copies of what are called biologic drugs. These are the mostly very expensive drugs that are difficult to duplicate, because it's not just a single chemical. It's part of a process. And only since the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010 has there even been a pathway to make these. They're called biosimilars, that they are basically generic copies of biologic drugs. And we're just starting to see those that obviously, would have hope of bringing down the cost of some of the most expensive drugs. But it's still very early in that process.
We're talking with Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. She's with us to talk about the high cost of prescription drugs and why President Trump called for a change to the pricing during this year's and last year's State of the Union addresses. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by high prescription drug prices? What would you like to see change about the system? Or do you think drug prices are reasonable and worth having more options? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about President Trump's call for prescription medication prices to be lowered and for more transparent drug pricing from hospitals and healthcare systems. Our guest is Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how drug prices are set in the United States? What would you like to see change when it comes to prescription drug pricing? Have you been impacted by the cost of prescription drugs? We'd like to hear about your experiences. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Julie, one of the recent developments in healthcare and access to medication is the right to try legislation that has been introduced and passed. First, tell us what right to try means.
Well, what right to try means is that people with terminal diseases can seek permission to try experimental drugs that have not been approved yet. Now, the Food and Drug Administration has long had processes for requesting these drugs. There were complaints that it was too cumbersome, although the FDA points out that they almost always say yes, and that the biggest block on people sort of trying investigational drugs outside of clinical trials, these may be people who are too sick to even get into clinical trials, are that the drug companies won't give up the drugs, that they may not have enough. They may worry about somebody who's about to die taking their drug and then dying and having that look bad when they go to get the drug approved. So right to try, and there were these right to try laws in many states. They've been pushed by the Libertarian Goldwater Institute in Arizona. There was a federal version of it, and it did pass. But the president was touting it both in his rally last week and in his State of the Union address. It turns out that, as far as we can tell, only two patients have so far been able to avail themselves of this law. Again, the problem is not so much the FDA. The problem is simply the ability to get it from the drug company, and the right to try law doesn't require the drug company to give up the drug to people who ask for it. I mean, the drug companies legitimately may not have enough. Remember, these are drugs that have not been approved yet. They're still investigational. They may only have enough for their own clinical trials.
I want to go back to last year's State of the Union again, January of 2018. In that speech, President Trump called on lawmakers to take up the issue, and here's what he said.
I am asking Congress to pass legislation that finally takes on the problem of global freeloading and delivers fairness and price transparency for American patients. Finally. We should also require drug companies, insurance companies, and hospitals to disclose real prices to foster competition and bring costs way down.
Julie, that's an interesting point that the president made there, because in a way it reminds me of when you go shopping for a ticket on an airline. You can look it up and it's one price, and then a half hour later or 3 days later, it can be a lot more, a lot less. It's hard to tell what the real cost is. And we have a lot of people who are saying that drug costs are the same. You might get one price at a drugstore, another one if you buy through your insurance, another if you don't. What makes it so complicated?
Well, that's exactly correct, and that's a really good analogy to the price of an airline ticket, although drug prices will vary way more than the price even of an airline ticket, which can, as you know, can change by hundreds of dollars depending on when you look or how many seats are left. And it's not just drug prices. The president, in talking about transparency, was talking about other prices, too. And, in fact, there's already been a requirement that just went into effect for hospitals to disclose their prices. And what people are discovering is that the prices that the hospitals disclose, first of all, it's very hard to tell what those prices are for. It's complicated. It's not really how you would be billed. But also, they may have no bearing in what you get charged. And the same thing is true in drugs. There's also a suggestion that drug companies be required to post their prices in their TV ads, those long TV ads that have those long lists of side effects. They would have to have the price in there. But what price would it be? The list price of the drug? The price that the pharmacy benefit manager negotiates for a private insurance company, the price that you might pay if you go to a drugstore, the price that you might pay if you order it through the mail. There are so many different prices that this has been one of the big frustrations, I think, for Republicans and for those who want more market forces in healthcare, is that even market forces, it's really hard to figure out how much things cost and how much you're going to get charged.
On Facebook, our listener Mari said, "We found that one of my prescriptions was cheaper not using our insurance. Go figure. Luckily, our pharmacy told us about it. We would have never guessed." So that's getting back to that issue, Julie, that it's hard to know what the real price is.
That's right. And there have even been laws that forbade pharmacists from telling customers that it would be cheaper if they bought it without their insurance. That's sort of how Byzantine this has gotten. Many of those have now gone away, but there were some rules that made that illegal for the pharmacist. I also bought a prescription for many years that was cheaper without insurance, although ultimately the drugstore I was using raised the price, and now it's cheaper with insurance. So that's the other thing, is you have to check. If you discover that's the case, it may be for a while, and then that all may change. You know, drug prices change, literally multiple times a day, every day, every time you refill a maintenance prescription. It is extremely difficult because it is so complicated.
Let's go to the phones, and Saeed in Green Bay is up. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
While I agree that this unrestrained pricing is very detrimental, and drug prices are the fastest growing segment of healthcare services, I concern myself about the impact of price controls on the emergence of new drugs. Because if you look at all the countries that have enacted price controls, they have pretty much significantly impacted the emergence of new drugs in those countries.
And thanks for that call, Saeed. That is an issue, Julie, that came up in some of the articles I was reading, that if there is someone who wants to invest several million dollars in, say, development of new drugs, or in, say, a startup app, and the amount that they can make is limited on drugs, that they might not invest in that.
Well, that is not just an issue. That has been the issue for the 30 years I've been watching this issue, that drug companies say it is expensive. There are a lot of dry holes. There are a lot of drugs that never turn out. If you don't let us basically reap a reward for having the drugs that succeed, then we won't be able to afford to continue to look for them. That you will stifle innovation, as they say. And that is to a point true, and particularly now that almost every other country has price controls. We're practically the only one that doesn't. What's changed in the last couple of years, though, is that we've seen the rise of some of these hedge funds, where people come in and they buy an older drug and they decide they can get some more money out of it, and they raise the price to whatever the market will bear. And these are investors, but they're not companies that are looking for new. They're not using the return to look for new drugs. They're simply pocketing the return because they can. That's a different issue than drug companies that are actually going out and trying to make the next generation of drugs.
Let's go back to the phones, and Dory in Madison is up. Hi, Dory.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about insulin, because that's a 100-year-old drug. There have been minor changes in delivery systems, but I don't think there have been changes in the drug itself very much. And I recently heard that it costs between $800 and $1,000 a pen for insulin. I don't know how many pens somebody with type 1 diabetes uses per month, but they may be using several $1,000s worth of insulin a month. And some people have started dying because they can't afford it.
And thanks for that call, Dory. And Julie, that is something that I've seen floating around on social media and elsewhere. What causes a sudden increase in the price of a drug that's been around forever?
Well, we have written about this a lot at Kaiser Health News. It is a big problem. Again, as caller mentioned, there have been some changes. There have been some advances in how insulin is made and how it's delivered, but not to the extent of the price increases, particularly that we've seen in very recent years. And it is a problem, and it's one of those things that, you know, there's a congressional subcommittee that is specifically looking into hikes in the cost of insulin. They're asking that there's only a couple of makers of insulin to explain why these prices have gone up so much. In some cases, people who have insulin pumps have systems that require them to only use a certain type of insulin, so they're basically, you know, unless they need to get an entirely new system, they basically have to pay. They have to buy that insulin. So there's not a lot of competition in the insulin market, or there's not as much competition as there could be in the insulin market. But you are also correct that we're seeing people who are unable to afford their insulin trying to ration it, which is very dangerous. And people do end up either getting very sick or in some cases dying because they haven't been able to afford the insulin that keeps them alive. So it's one of those issues that I think is pushing Congress to perhaps act on this when in years past they've kind of wrung their hands about this issue but not done anything.
Well, and in our last minute, Julie, that's exactly where I was hoping to get to. This seems like an issue that for the most part has bipartisan support, that people across the political spectrum are affected by in very personal ways. What is the next step to be able to address this issue somehow?
Well, just later this month, some of the CEOs of the top pharmaceutical companies are going to come testify before the Senate Finance Committee, which is in charge of Medicare and Medicaid on the Senate side. The new chairman of that committee, Charles Grassley of Iowa, has long been skeptical of the drug industry. That's much different from his predecessor. So it is possible now that the House has been taken over by Democrats. The president wants to do something about this. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee wants to do something about drug prices. We could actually see action this year that we haven't seen in many, many years.
Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Julie Ravner is the Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. She joined us to talk about President Trump's call for lower prescription price drugs. Coming up after the news, can you name the branches of Wisconsin government? How about how many congressional districts we have? We'll find out how you might do in the Wisconsin Civics Games. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Most would agree that being an informed citizen and voter is important. But for a lot of people, the last time they actively learned about how the government works was years ago in high school, or maybe even earlier. A competition sponsored by the Wisconsin Newspaper Association Foundation is hoping to inspire young people, and the rest of us, to be more active and engaged in civic life. Eve Galanter is a big proponent of the Wisconsin Civics Games. She's a Wisconsin Newspaper Association Foundation board member and former Madison City Council member. She also served as the director of Senator Herb Kohl's Madison office. Eve, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Judith.
So what exactly do we mean by civics?
That's an interesting question. What we found is that knowledge of how government works, an understanding of when you say there ought to be a law, what would you do about it? How are you going to understand the foundations of how government works? And Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who in her most recent report to the public saying she was retiring from public life, said, there's no more important work than deepening young people's engagement in our nation. And my own background and commitment to public service, a kind of an obsession with government, led me to be very concerned when, appropriately enough, I saw a headline in the Wisconsin State Journal a couple of years ago that said, all three school board incumbents running unopposed. I had nothing wrong with all the people who were serving. They were doing a great job. But why was there no more interest? Were people aware of the opportunity to serve in the public? And I was concerned enough that I began talking to people about what's happening with public service. Why are people not engaged? The notion of civic engagement and more recently civil engagement and bolstering an interest in public service. There was a survey that was done by the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance and for the League of Municipalities, and they found that of the over 500 cities and villages in Wisconsin, 52% of those had officials who said they had 0 to 1 candidate per seat over the last 3 years, even when there was no incumbent. Perhaps only one person ran or none. There was a need to fill a gap of making people feel enthusiastic about knowing more about how government works.
Well, I'm guessing, Eve, too, that not everyone, for a variety of reasons, would be able to or would want to run for office. But this also, I'm guessing, is hoping to encourage more people to vote, because our voting levels are often well behind many other countries.
You're absolutely right. And public service means not only seeking elected office. You can serve on a city committee or commission. You can work in government or with government without having to seek elected office, which for many people is a kind of daunting task.
We're talking with Eve Galanter. She's a Wisconsin Newspaper Association Foundation board member, and we're talking about their Wisconsin Civics Games, which the finals are going to be happening later this month. And so, Eve, let's talk about the Wisconsin Civics Games. How are they structured? Who's competing?
The Civics Games, which were originally called the Civics Bowl, but people thought Civics Games sounded more interesting.
It sounds more Olympian.
Especially to high school students. And that was really part of the focus when I brought this to the Newspaper Association Foundation, to encourage interest. What do you need to do? You need to have competition. You need to have some fun. You need to have a sense of seeking to gain knowledge, but also to having it tested in a fun and rewarding way. So we sent information to every high school in Wisconsin saying, we're launching the Wisconsin Civics Games. Teams of students in high school of up to 4 students per team can compete one-on-one, like the old-fashioned college bowl, to determine who would move forward and after a regional competition to the finals, which are going to be held on Saturday, February 23rd at the state capitol. Students are advancing from the Green Bay area and Rice Lake area and Madison, Milwaukee, Platteville, to compete in their knowledge of what goes on in our Wisconsin state government, what happens in looking at current affairs, reading the newspaper and saying, you know, if that's going to happen, I know what will happen next or how we might address that. The exciting thing, too, is that because of the support of many of our sponsors, whether it's the League of Municipalities and the EVU Foundation and the Wisconsin Counties Association, with lots of volunteers from the League of Women Voters, we are going to be offering $2,000 scholarship to the members of the winning team.
Wow.
To attend a Wisconsin college or university.
Wow.
So knowledge of civics and civic engagement has a real payoff.
It pays
here.
Off. Well, Eve, I want to give people a sense of what kind of questions these students are preparing to answer, and I'm guessing that they are preparing to answer well. Here are a couple that you gave me. One is, in January, the federal government had a partial shutdown of agencies because no budget had been approved. In Wisconsin, if no budget is approved, what would happen? And what would happen?
What would happen? I'm curious, as your listeners are thinking about that, do they know that what would happen in Wisconsin is that the previous year's budget and appropriations would apply until a new budget is approved.
So it's basically an automatic continuing resolution.
It is, and it is automatic. We do not have to go through what many people went mm-hmm. through with the federal shutdown.
And there are proposals to make that the case at the federal level.
That is correct.
Well. So here's another one. I hope everybody out there has their thinking caps on. In the original Wisconsin Constitution, with some modifications over time, it is one of the oldest state constitutions in the nation. There are two ways that that state constitution can be changed. What are those two ways?
Well, one I think that most people are familiar with is by amending it, a process that happens first in the state legislature over consecutive sessions, and then it goes out on to referendum for the people of Wisconsin to vote on it.
And that has been done.
That has been done. I think most recently I think the voters will remember that we changed the method by which the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was selected, moving from seniority to election by colleagues on the other justices on the Supreme Court. The second method,
which has not been used before, but is on the books, correct?
That is now. Oh no, that was by amendment to the Constitution.
No, yes. but the second way that you can change it has never been
used. And people are very concerned about convening a constitutional convention. What would happen if we suddenly opened up the Constitution to anybody who had an idea? What would happen? What would it overturn? Mm-hmm. Would it be things that you care about or something that I care about? And would they be the same?
So that's an example of the kinds of questions that are asked. What do you hear from the students who participate in the games?
Well, I both hear from and I've watched those students. We had a break at the regional games, the one that was held here in Madison at the Union South. And during lunch, when I expected the room would just be filled with chatter and everybody being very relaxed, they were testing each other using this book called The Framework of Wisconsin Government that we provided to the teachers of every school that registered. Another unique thing about this is that no fee was involved for any school to participate, and we, with the support of sponsors and with all of the UW Wisconsin campuses who donated the space in which the games were held, we really feel very, very fortunate. And the students' enthusiasm is really contagious. I think it is something new, but what we are hoping to do is build on this year's success. We had originally 54 teams register from around the state. The polar vortex played a few games on us. But the second annual, we hope that more teams will look at what happened this year and that teachers and students will be encouraged to join us in this wonderful and exciting opportunity to learn, engage, and think about public service.
Well, Eve, as we wrap up, what is the best way for, say, a teacher or a student who's listening and thinks, wow, I really want to be part of that next year, or maybe wants to watch the finals, if that's possible? What's the best way to get information?
Well, first of all, if you want to watch the finals, it is free and open to the public in room 411 south of our wonderful state capitol. There will be introduction by Chief Justice Rogensack. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is going to be coming by after lunch. And if you want more information, please go to WisconsinCivicsGames.com. And if you've got ideas for questions, you can contact me at WNA@WNANews.com.
And I'll just say that's Wisconsin Civics, plural,
games.com. All one word.
Well, Eve, thanks so much for joining us today, and it'll be exciting to see who comes out on top.
Thanks.
Eve Galanter is a Wisconsin Newspaper Association Foundation board member and former Madison City Council member. She joined us to talk about the Wisconsin Civics Games. The final will be on February 23rd at the state capitol. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. President Trump is poised to sign an agreement that would provide funding for southern border security and avert another partial government shutdown like the one we saw in January. The agreement reached by congressional lawmakers comes ahead of tomorrow's deadline and was passed by the Senate this afternoon. Representative Brian Steil joins us now to talk about the border negotiations and more. Steil is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. Representative Steil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So can you briefly tell us what is in this new agreement?
Man, it's a lot going on in this agreement. We got about 1,200 pages late last night that we need to be voting on. This afternoon, early this evening. And so it's a frustrating process to how we got here in the first place. But fair enough, that's where we're at. We've made some progress on funding our border security needs. And so we're not all the way to President Trump's request, $5.7 billion, but we're a long way off the $0 approach that Nancy Pelosi was at. And so the compromise number is going to be about $1.3 billion for a permanent structure at the southern border, which I think is a step in the right direction. It's not as far as I would like to go, but that's a bit of the nature of compromise. And so what we're going to have is a bill that now passed the Senate. It's going to come to the House tonight. It prevents the shutdown. It moves us forward. It's not everything that I would like to see in it, but it's definitely a step forward in the right direction and prevents us from going into the kind of the catastrophic shutdown mode that we were in when I first arrived in Congress.
As you said, there's a lot going on and a lot of pieces to kind of get a handle on. What I was seeing is that the amount that is in this deal that goes directly to border security is very similar to the amount that was proposed in the beginning of December that the president rejected. Is there a significant difference in this agreement that makes it more palatable?
Well, I arrived on the scene starting January 3rd, and so the previous negotiations that were taking place before my tenure, starting January 3rd when I arrived, I think where we're at is a respectable spot. We're going to get enhanced border security. We're moving the ball forward on that piece. I would like to see us go further, but we're going to get that opportunity again as we go through the next appropriations process. And hopefully we have a much better process, a more thoughtful approach, and end up with a much better product next time.
Do you feel like the negotiations between your GOP colleagues and the Democrats were in good faith on both sides in this current phase of negotiations?
I think in the most recent phase, it sounds like people finally came to the table and had a conversation. And so what I argued from the beginning is what we need to do is have more of a conversation, figure out how we're going to solve this thing and get it done. And so the first 35 days, where the government was shut down, often the two sides weren't even talking. My first speech on the House floor was exactly that. Let's all get locked in a room, 435 members of the House, 100 members of the Senate, the president, take our cell phones away, and let's work on this problem until we have a solution. And so my approach is maybe a little bit more of a private sector approach. I spent the last 10 years working in the manufacturing sector in Wisconsin near my hometown of Janesville. I think we need to have more of a conversation. Let's get things done. Let's reach solutions that moves the ball forward. It's not going to be perfect for everyone. This bill, not perfect for everyone, but definitely a step in the right direction.
We're talking with Brian Steil right now. He is a member of Congress representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. And Representative Steil, today on the Senate floor, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the president had indicated that he is seeking other ways to fund the wall.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump, and he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time. And I've indicated to him that I'm going to support the national emergency declaration.
So Representative Steil, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says that he is supporting the signing and the concurrent national emergency declaration. What is your stance on that decision?
I'm a bit more of a constitutional conservative. I would like to see the power of the purse strings remain in Congress, remain as close to the people as possible, and force Congress to vote on these things. I don't, you know, prioritizing funding on the southern border and securing our border, I think, is critical. But getting into a situation where the president's declaring emergencies makes me concerned. I want to see the language that the president's going to use, where the funding sources are. But ultimately, I'm a bit of a constitutional conservative, and I'd like to see the House of Representatives and the Senate be the decision makers to where we're spending our funds.
You just said that you'd like to know where the money's coming from, and President Trump has said on many occasions that there's money available. He has money he can move around. Do you, as a member of Congress, as a member of the president's party, have a sense of where he would be pulling that money from?
Well, there's a handful of spots where the president does have some levels of authority to move money inside priority areas. But until the president were to actually identify which funds he's proposing to use, it's hard to comment because you're in a bit in the abstract. And so, you know, until we see what the president's determination is, and he hasn't shared that publicly, I know he had a private conversation with the Senate Majority Leader. I'm not privy to the details of that. I want to see where we're talking about pulling the funds before I'd make a determination if that's an appropriate use of executive authority.
It does sound like a new partial government shutdown will be averted if the president signs his deal before the deadline, whether or not it comes with the National Emergency Declaration. We spoke with your colleague, Democratic Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District last week, and he said no one in Congress wants to see another shutdown. And he also said that if it did happen, and again, that the blame would squarely be on President Trump. What do you think, if we ended up in that position again, who's to blame?
I mean, we're probably all to blame. We shouldn't go back into a shutdown. And the finger pointing that is the parlor game of Washington, D.C. doesn't help us. And so pox on all of our house if we can't figure out how to fund the government. If you were working in a business and you shut the business down because people couldn't figure out a solution, you should all be tossed out. And so that's a little bit of my approach. That's why, in part, I went and introduced a piece of legislation that would end all government shutdowns going forward. It would put in place a continuing resolution, kind of like the state of Wisconsin, where we don't shut the state government down if we can't reach a budget. We just fund it at a continuous level. I've introduced that legislation. Democrats and Republicans are on board. And it would finally be a proactive approach to prevent future government shutdowns. I'd like to see some proactive thoughtfulness once we get to the other side of this spending bill.
Representative Stile, this is your first month in Congress that you're finishing up. It's been quite a month, I think, for everyone. What's your takeaway been so far?
You know, you're probably twofold. One, there's a lot of dysfunction in Washington. I think we need to have more of a conversation with our colleagues. We're not always going to agree on everything, but we might walk away learning a little bit from each and every one of us. I held 6 listening sessions across Southeast Wisconsin, one in each of the 6 counties of the 1st Congressional District. And I did that because I think, you know, there needs to be a little more conversation, a Wisconsin-style approach. And I think we'd all walk away learning a little bit from each other rather than what goes on in Washington, which is this constant finger-pointing and is unproductive. The other side of what you learn in Washington, though, is there is some opportunities here. I walked off the floor of the Capitol after my first day in Washington a little before 10 p.m., and you come down the steps of our nation's capital, and you look back up, and you see the rotunda, and you see the Capitol lit up in lights, and you think of the great history of the United States. We've survived challenging times before. We're in them now. We need to stay focused and continue to move forward because we have the most spectacular country in the entire world, and there's great opportunity in front of us as well.
Well, Representative Stile, thanks so much for joining us today and for taking the time from your busy schedule.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Representative Brian Stile is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. He joined us today to talk about the border deal and his first month in Congress. Again, we spoke with Ron Kind last week. Whether you're a fan of jazz, country, rock, or classical music, there are plenty of songs to choose from as a soundtrack to this holiday that's dedicated to romance and love. But where to start? Well, hosts on WPR's News and Classical Music Network have you covered. They've put together a Valentine's Day playlist that includes everything from Buddy Guy to Antonin Dvorak, from the Indigo Girls to Tchaikovsky. You can find the whole list and thoughts from hosts Jonathan Overby, Dan Robinson, Stephanie Elkins, Anders Joachim, and more over at WPR.org. There's so many great songs to choose from there, and I really love that they found four different versions to share of Our Love Is Here to Stay. We'll leave you with some Tony Bennett and Diana Krall's duet. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Our love is here to stay.